This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. One of the things that's kept me sane this past year is ending nearly every weekday by watching The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. The most troubling things related to COVID and politics are typically what he focuses on in his monologues. Not only are they hilarious, but he nails just what makes the day's news disturbing or absurd. Those monologues are well-researched, too. It's one of the ways I keep up with the news. I've been a fan of Colbert's since he was a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, where, among other things, he did a recurring segment called This Week in God, in which he typically satirized the news related to religious extremism. He left The Daily Show to do his own show, The Colbert Report, in which he satirized the news in persona as a right-wing blowhard TV cable news host, modeled in part on Bill O'Reilly. He's been hosting The Late Show since September 2015, just a few months after Trump announced he was running for office. Colbert has joined us several times on Fresh Air. The last time was the week before Trump won the election back in 2016. So we have a lot of catching up to do. Stephen Colbert, welcome back to Fresh Air. I just love having you on the show. Thank you so much for coming back.
Well, I'm so happy to be here. As we were about to start the interview, I was thinking, when was the last time you and I spoke? I didn't realize it was that long ago. Yeah, there's been a whole different kingdom of anxiety and distressing news has risen and fallen in those 4 years.
So you work so hard, you keep such crazy hours, and I always wondered, like, how do you find time to spend with your wife and children? But for several months, you were spending all your time at home where your wife and two of your sons were, and your family became part of the show. And I want to play an example of that. And this is from last Mother's Day. One of the bits that you do for certain holidays is that it's first draft. Like you read a kind of corny greeting card for the holiday, and then you read a really funny version of what the first draft might have sounded like, which is always kind of nasty and more honest. So you're asking, you know, you're at home and you're asking for an assistant to help you read the first draft, or to hand you the cards. And here's how that bit went.
As always, when doing first drafts for Mother's Day, I need a mom volunteer from the audience to come up and help me out. Let's see. Yes, you, miss. Could you come join me up
yes.
here? Thank you very much.
Okay. Oh, God.
There you go. Watch the tangle there. This is my wife, Evie. Say hello.
Hello.
Hi. Now, happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. First of all. Thank you.
Normally we would take you out for a Mother's Day brunch or something like that.
We never do that.
We've never done that. Okay. No. I don't know why I said that. Okay. What do we normally do? Coffee and breakfast in bed.
Yeah,
exactly.
In bed.
For many years, I made you scones.
You did.
Exactly.
And granola and fruit.
Exactly. The girls.
We have one girl. The kids. Two boys.
The kids would bring you breakfast in bed. Yeah.
You're nervous.
I am a little nervous to have you on here. I'm a little nervous to have you on here. I want this to be a good experience for you.
I'll come back.
You'll come back? Okay, good. Okay.
I live here.
Have you seen First Drafts before, young lady?
I have.
I thought that was so delightful. Evie's funny. Did she ever do comedy?
Oh, she was an actress. I mean, she wasn't a comedian. Like, that wasn't her specific calling, but she was an actress.
So how did it change your family life to work at home and to work with your family?
Well, it's been great. It's been one of the few positive aspects of this whole thing. And I think this is a common experience for a lot of people, as hard as the COVID restrictions have been and the anxiety and the shock about how much it's spread in the United States. We've got to spend a lot of time with the people we love, with our family. Our youngest was about to go off to college, and he deferred for a year because of this. And we got another year with him. He's actually still here with us. That's been an extraordinary thing. But having them work on the show, we were all living together for that. Even my daughter was there too. She's grown with a job, but she was doing her job like a couple rooms over. I remember her coming over and going, "Cause is there any way you could be a little quieter?" I'm like, "No, I'm doing a television show. I can't whisper The Late Show tonight." It's been great. Like I've really kept, I mean, everybody in the family's done like bits on the shows over the years, but to have them intimately involved. Like my elder of my two boys, he was there like every day running everything, like the sound, the cameras, the lights, the satellite connection, the switching, all the switching that we needed to do for the virtual control room. And he was just there for 2 weeks. And then he said, "Dad, I'm not going to graduate from college if I keep helping you. I can't do this job." So then my younger son took over. And then he's like, "I'm not going to graduate from high school if I keep helping you." So then Evie took over. And it's been great. It felt very old fashioned, like, you know, the old days before everyone went off to work at factories. And that's what the modern workplace is kind of based upon, the industrial revolution of like everybody leaves the home to go work at the central place. Actually doing this show out of the home, like it was kind of a cottage industry, made it feel very much very 19th century, like the kids are going to come help dad cut the wood every day or something. And it's been intimate and wonderful, and something I would never experienced in another way. And in a very valuable way, erased my public life from erased the line between my public life and my private life in a way that I think is, I don't know, maybe made them understand more what my life is like, and made me appreciate that I don't have to live such an insular public life separated from my private life, which is actually kind of helpful to the kind of show that I do.
What's it like having Evie when she sits right across from you as the audience? Because, like, my husband's a critic. He's a tough crowd. So if he was sitting across from me while I was doing the show, it would really make me nervous.
Well, it does, as you saw in that clip. Like, I want this to be a good experience for her. And it's certainly having somebody in the room with you while you're creating a show, especially a show under these conditions where it's not a natural way to do one of these shows. So it's very stop and start. The people at home have no idea how many takes it took me to do that monologue.
Oh, really?
Because it's much harder without an audience.
Yeah, sure.
I'm much more likely to mess up and have to retake something, lose the rhythm of a joke, or even just misread the prompter without an audience there. Because there's some vital performance adrenaline spark that's missing that the audience provides. And so my wife and my kids have seen me absolutely shank monologues over and over again. And it's very humbling for them to realize that I'm not that good at this. And that there's an editing process that really makes it look like I know what the hell I'm doing. And I remember thinking, God, I wish I could just find a way to do material that Evie would laugh at, or that if I could make an audience laugh the way I can make Evie laugh, because it felt real and genuine and a real connection. And that the intimacy and the genuine sort of like happy laugh that comes with joking around with Evie is something that I had always thought, if I could do that, I'll make it, because that'll be something special. And now, I'm not going to say at the end of my career, but deeply into my career, I finally have that opportunity for that to be the only concern when she's there is, I wonder if Evie's going to like this joke. I wonder if I could do this in a way that Evie will like. And it gives me enormous joy when I hear her laugh. And I swear to God, if it was a good show that night, listen, you'll hear her laughing. Because I'd say I'm 75% better as a host of the show if she's sitting in her little red chair across the room.
Oh, that's great. And I feel like I'm laughing with her when she's laughing. So, that's...
Yeah, because she does not suffer fools. You'll also, if you listen carefully, you'll hear her go, "Oh, no." She'll sometimes go like, "Oh, no." Because she'll be like, "I'm not getting on board with that one. No,
And what do you do? How do you respond to that?
I often out loud on air, I go, "What? That now this is too far?" That's what I like about it. What?
How have all the changes of the pandemic and the constant concerns about protecting yourself and your family from getting the virus, how has that affected your mood? I know you're vaccinated now, so I'm hoping Evie is too, and that, you know, the concern about that has hopefully diminished a little bit. But it's been a year of high anxiety. How's that affected your mood, your spirits?
I miss people. I really like the company of people. I miss going to dinner. I miss hugging people. I'm a hugger. I like hugging people randomly. I feel lonely a lot. When I'm I go to the theater to actually produce the show. We rewrite everything from home. Everybody's at home. And myself and a very small group of people Matter of fact, I only see about four or five of them. Others come in at staggered intervals throughout the day. Come into this little storage closet where we do the show, and I do the show and I leave as quickly as I can. So we're all together for the shortest possible period of time, maybe a couple hours. And then we all go home and get ready to write the show from home again the next day. And it's lonely. I got into show business in a way to not be alone. Like a lot of comedians, I'm a bit of a broken toy.
So Joe Biden is the president now. You spoke with him in 2015 when he was vice president. I think at the time he was maybe still considering a possible run in 2016 when you interviewed him. But if he was considering it, he hadn't announced yet.
You know, he had actually considered it and come to the conclusion that he couldn't do it. And that's one of the things he talked about on the show.
I want to play just a short clip from that interview. And just to set it up, you know, you were talking to him about the losses in his life, his son, Bo, who had recently died earlier in his life when his wife and his daughter were killed in a car crash and his sons were hospitalized and his whole life was turned upside down. And you were approaching it, too, from the fact that you know loss because when you were 10, your father and two of your brothers were killed in a plane crash. So Biden is talking here about how much advice his parents had given him over the years about how you have to keep getting up and moving forward, and how he admires people who, you know, with less means than he has, are able to kind of get up and keep going after loss. So let's pick it up over there.
Oh, we're going through horrible things, and they get up every morning and they put one foot in front of the other, and they don't have, like I said, anything like the support I have. I marvel at the ability of people to absorb hurt and just get back up. And most of them do it with an incredible sense of empathy to other people. I mean, it's interesting. The people I find who I'm most drawn to are people who have been hurt, and yet, I'm not going to embarrass you, but you're one of them, old buddy. No. Your mom, your family, losing your dad when you're kid and three brothers. I mean, you know, it's like asking, what made your mother do it every day? How did she get up every single day with, you know, 11 kids to start? I mean, it's just...
Well, she had to take care of me.
Well...
She did. No, that's it. We were there
for
each other.
By the way, that must have been a hell of a job.
And I had to take care of her.
That's the point.
I had to take care of her.
That's the point.
You know? Yeah.
Can I ask you something?
So listening to that, you know, I'm thinking, then Biden becomes president. You shared this, like, really, you seem to, like, really connect in that moment, both talking about your losses and how you admired each other for being able to carry on. And now you've shared that emotional moment, but now you're in the position of satirizing him. After that interview, did you say to Biden, like, and you know I'm going to have to keep doing jokes about you?
I did get a call from Biden when he looked like he might be running for president. Jon Stewart came on. We do these things where we flip every so often and have the guest interview me. And we do it for, like, just for a special. And Jon Stewart said, well, what did you think you got a sense of how to interview people as yourself? And I said, oh, when I was talking to Joe Biden the first time in 2015, pretty early on, the interviews were the first thing that changed before I sort of learned how to do material as myself. And I said, and after Joe Biden came on, he walked off stage and I said to my executive producer, Tom Purcell, I said, I think that nice old man just gave me my show. And what I meant was how you actually talk to someone as myself, because what he was sharing with me in that moment was so intimate and speaking so specifically to my own experience that the only way to receive it was really as the real me. And it cracked something open for me when he was talking to me. And as soon as I said that nice old man, I went, oh, damn it, he's going to see this and he's not going to like that. And sure enough, the next day I got a call and I knew it was him because somebody said he's going to be calling you. And my assistant goes, what is he calling you about? And I said, he's calling me about the nice old man thing. And she goes, no, he's not going to care. I'm like, if he's running for president, he's really going to care. That's what I'll know if he's running for president. And so I got the call and I put him on speaker and he goes, listen, buddy, if you ever call me a nice old man again, I'm going to come down there and personally kick your ass. And I said, I promise you I won't, sir. You're clearly not that nice.
Yes, because you make fun of his age all the time.
Right, and that's, you know, that's the sorbet for the jokes to come, I assume.
You're deep into science fiction and fantasy and talk about that all the time on your show. Star Wars, Tolkien, were those kind of alternate universes helpful to you as a kid? Especially like when you were dealing with your grief and your mother's grief after your father and two brothers were killed?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. I mean, I wasn't conscious of it at the time. I remember a teacher asking a friend of mine, why does he always read science fiction and fantasy? Because I was a very poor student. I barely graduated from high school. And I was a terrible student from the moment that they died. I just didn't care anymore. But I read almost a book a day. Like, I read constantly, all fantasy and science fiction. And I had an enormous amount of it because my oldest two brothers, Jim and Ed, had been born in the 40s, had been reading science fiction during a real golden age during the 50s and the early 60s. And I had all of their books. So I was reading deep cut stuff like L. Sprague de Camp and A.E. Van Vogt and Henry Kuttner and C.L. Moore and people nobody reads anymore. Or rather, you know, you have to be really into it to know some of these names. And they were an escape. You know, they're still an escape. I still will go back to Roger Zelazny or Stephen R. Donaldson or some of the fantasy writers of my youth to have that sort of comfort food of a alternate world to soothe me.
When your mother died and you did a really moving obit for her on your show, you mentioned that she had trained to be an actress and she used to do like stage falls in the kitchen,
yeah,
make believe she was fainting.
Yes.
So did that help you? Did it help inspire you to want to be an actor?
Sure. Well, she was enthusiastic about the idea, which was helpful.
Yeah, most parents aren't.
Right, exactly. She was enthusiastic. As she used to, as she said to me after I had a certain amount of success, she said, you know, I was never worried about you. And she said, I don't know why, because there's plenty of reasons to worry, but I wasn't worried about you. And I think that lack of worry, that enthusiasm, that no, you go do that. Go be what you want to be. I remember reading her the lyrics to Finishing a Hat from Sunny in the Park, and which I had just seen on probably Great Performances. And reading it to her and saying, I don't know how, but in some way I have to do this. But I don't know in what way, but this, the same way that the song talks about the hat, looking through the world of the hat like a window from this world to that, like the hat itself is a window and into this greater possibility of creating. That song was a window. And that musical, which is not the prettiest image of what that life is like. Same thing for All That Jazz, a very warts and all image of what it's like to be in a creative artist. But knowing when I saw that movie going, oh, I want to do that. I don't know why, but I want to do that. Warts and all, darkness and all, death and all. And I think that my mother wanted to be an actress said to me that this is a valuable thing to want to be. I think that's the way. And then later, I came to realize that I think I knew how happy it made her to see this dream playing out through someone else. But I didn't feel any pressure in that way, just the invitation.
So, you know, you were the youngest of all of her children, and you were living with her. Your other siblings had grown up and left home already, I think, when your father died. And, you know, you've talked about how she helped you through it and you helped her through it. Was it hard for you to leave and go out of town when you first did, whether it was for college or to go to New York to act? Was it hard for you to leave her because you'd been so close and helped each other so much? And you were the last child, so there was going to be nobody left.
Sure, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Talk about a good laugh. My mom had a great laugh and a great sense of humor. And I think maybe because she had wanted to be an actress and studied to be an actress, she wasn't a prude. So she was game for jokes about a lot of different things. But I could tell when she didn't mean her laughter. I could tell when she was actually very sad and the laughter was just to cover it. And I remember shortly before I went off to college, listening to her talking to someone, and I could tell, and I don't know what it was, but she was not emotionally well in that moment. And the laughter she used to cover that in that conversation in the next room was painful to hear, because I knew the difference. And I thought, oh, when I go off, no one else will hear the difference. And I worried that there'd be no one around to care for her in that moment. That no one would, because she was very good at laughing to cover it. She was very socialized and a wonderful, gracious hostess and extraordinarily charming. But I could tell the difference, and I was just, I was brokenhearted for her, that I knew there'd be times that would be happening and no one would know that she wasn't okay.
Stephen Colbert, it has just been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for your show and for coming back to our show.
I've so enjoyed talking to you. It's always great to talk to you. And you remain, in my mind, the greatest interviewer working today.
Stephen Colbert hosts The Late Show on CBS. Monday will mark NPR's 50th anniversary, the day All Things Considered premiered. NPR would not be what it is today without my two guests, Bill Siemering, the creator of All Things Considered, and Susan Stamberg, the co-anchor of the show from 1972 to 86. Bill hired Susan as a production assistant a month before All Things Considered, ATC, was first broadcast. When she became the co-host 1 year later, she was the first woman to become the anchor of a daily national news program in America. She disproved all the stereotypes about women's voices lacking authority. She had plenty of it, and she had warmth, a sense of humor, and a personality listeners loved that helped define the identity of the show and the network. After leaving ATC, she became the founding host of Weekend Edition Sunday. She's now a special correspondent for NPR. In addition to her many radio awards, she has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Bill Siemering was the first director of programming at NPR. He created a philosophy and an aesthetic for NPR and ATC. He wrote the network's first mission statement, saying that NPR should reflect the diversity of America and let the country hear itself. The mission statement is so eloquent and remains so timely. It's still quoted today as a source of inspiration. Bill has spent his life in public media, at NPR and managing several stations. He founded the NGO Developing Radio Partners to strengthen community radio in developing countries. He's continuing his public media work as a senior fellow with the Wincote Foundation. When I started in radio, in the mid-70s, when women were trying to break in, it was so inspiring to hear Susan hosting All Things Considered. Bill holds a special place in my life and in the life of our show. From 1978 to 87, he was the station manager at WHYY, where our show is produced. Fresh Air began as a local show, and it would never have become a national show without him. But that's a story for another time. It is such a pleasure to present Susan and Bill together in this interview. Bill Siemering, Susan Stamberg, welcome to Fresh Air. Happy anniversary. Bill, I want to read an excerpt of your now famous NPR mission statement that you wrote in 1970, the year before NPR actually signed on the air. And you wrote that the program, meaning All Things Considered, would be well-paced, flexible, and a service primarily for a general audience. It would not, however, substitute superficial blandness for genuine diversity of regions, values, and cultural and ethnic minorities which comprise American society. It would speak with many voices and many dialects. And it was also important for you to have the arts, literature, poetry represented on All Things Considered. You wanted the show to have an aesthetic, a sensibility, not just straight up hard news coverage. And then you also wrote in your mission statement, the programs will enable the individual, meaning the listener, to better understand himself, his government, his institutions, and his natural and social environment so he can intelligently participate in affecting the process of change. What did you mean by affecting the process of change?
Well, change is a given, and it's how those changes are made and what are the intentions of the changes that are really important. And by having the information to understand the context by which change decisions are made, they'll be more intelligent. We can't make the right decisions with the wrong information. And one of the problems now, I think, is public ignorance is a great threat to the country because people are believing things that are untrue and they can't make the right decisions based on that.
Bill, you hired Susan Stamberg at NPR. What did you see in her when you hired her? You obviously made a brilliant choice. But you didn't know what she would become. That was all the future. So what did you see in her? Why did you want to hire her?
Her curiosity and her energy, and she has this wonderful voice that is expressive, has rich tone color, and it's the sound I really wanted for NPR. It's a sound that I still think represents NPR the best. This insatiable curiosity, and Susan has a lot of fun also. I didn't need to look at her resume, really. I just said, I was really quite blown away by Susan when she came in the office, and I knew that's what I wanted.
Bill, it was suggested to you when you were first working on finding a host for All Things Considered, and Susan didn't start hosting until the second year the show was on the air. It was suggested to you that you hired an established network TV reporter who was experienced and can come in, people already had faith in, and they'd have this like authoritative male voice. And that's not what you wanted to do. Why did you resist that? And what did you have to do to resist it?
I didn't get a lot of pressure. Fortunately, Don Quayle, the president, was very good about this. And he also supported Susan. He was the one that recommended Susan come in to see me. Now, the stations were expecting the big voice. They were expecting us, finally, we've got our own network and we'll sound just like CBS. And we had a meeting of station managers a few weeks after All Things started. And it was kind of a hostile audience. I mean, they were saying, who are these people? And I said, well, your listeners will get to know them. It's okay. And they, of course, did. But it took a while for people to get used to what we were doing and to accept it. But I remember even in September, the manager of WETA in Washington came to me and said, you know, if this doesn't get better, we're going to take it off the air.
Wow.
And actually, on the first day of the program, one of the board members said, our child has been born and it is ugly.
Oh, no. Wow. How did that make you feel?
I didn't know that till much later. But a year and a half after we started, the program won a Peabody Award, so it got pretty.
Susan, so you became co-anchor of All Things Considered about a year after it started. I would like to play your first broadcast hosting the show, and this was before you were a full-time anchor. You were substituting for Mike Waters. This is the opening billboard of the first show that you hosted as a substitute host on All Things Considered. The date of this is March 1st, 1972.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
This is Art Cohen in Manchester, New Hampshire, and on tonight's All Things Considered, I'll be reporting on the significance of next Tuesday's primary.
Primaries in New Hampshire will be followed by primaries in Florida, where one of the Democratic candidates has been winning much popular support.
He speaks. speaks for the little people. He speaks for us. He always has. He always will. Wallace is the only one that speaks the truth, as far as I'm concerned.
Tonight on All Things Considered, supporters of George Wallace discuss the reasons for their support. Also tonight, a conversation with an electronic music virtuoso.
Okay. Susan, what do you think about when you hear that?
Well, I'm hearing how carefully I was speaking. I'm a New Yorker, and I was working, and always have for much of my broadcasting life in particular, against a pretty heavy New York accent that I had. So I hear myself, I would never today say that my name was Susan Stamberg, but I would say Stamberg. But I heard myself being really careful with it. On the other hand, I am the first woman who has anchored a national nightly news broadcast. And when I started, in my memory, I was far more deep voice than I sounded on that piece of tape, because there had been no role models. The only thing I could think was to imitate the men. And I was doing exactly what Bill said. He didn't want to hear on the air. That is one of these voices from on top of the mountain from some commercial network, you know, something that many of the station managers wanted to hear. But I'll tell you the story, and it shows so much about Bill's leadership. He didn't tell me this story until something like 11 years later, the notion of complaints and criticism from station managers who said a woman's voice is not authoritative, she will not be taken seriously, she should not be delivering the news. I never heard that till maybe 11 years after I'd been doing it, because he had such confidence in me, and he knew it would throw me, you know, if he had said anything to me at the time. And he also knew that people would get used to hearing me, to hearing a woman delivering the news. But the most valuable thing that he said at the time, as I was trying to be as authoritative, in quotes, as those men, was, be yourself. And I thought, what could he mean? What? Oh, my goodness. I mean, Terry, nobody says that to you. Nobody says be yourself except Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. Other people say sit up straight, cut your hair, comb your hair, lose 5 pounds, you know, but make some correction. But not Bill. He said, be yourself, because that's what he wanted to hear on the radio, the natural sound of human beings talking to one another.
Susan, you said that Bill encouraged you to be yourself, and that's what you became. And you showed like warmth and empathy, as well as having good news judgment and being really informed. But you talked to a lot of artists and just kind of people, and yeah, there was warmth. You had a personality on the air, and people loved that. I mean, you were famous for that. That helped define what NPR stood for. How did you gradually let yourself come through and figure out, like, what was your on-air personality? Who were you on the air, being true to yourself, but also being, you know, a radio professional?
Thank you for all of that. It was all sort of an accumulation. I mean, it certainly didn't happen all at once. And I would listen carefully after we went off the air to what it sounded like and what struck my ear and changes that I thought I ought to make the next day. But again, I had tremendous guidance from Bill, as always, from a phrase from that mission statement. And it was that one of the goals of National Public Radio would be to celebrate life. And I sort of devoted myself to that. First of all, the arts were always so important to me from the time that I was a child. And I loved music, and I loved poetry, and I loved visual arts, all of that. And being raised in New York, I was lucky enough to be able to be exposed to some of the best of that. And I carried that love with me into the broadcasting that I did, and very unusually for those early days, and even today, brought it to the news broadcasts. As you were saying, you never heard anything like that on formal news programs, except when you turned to public radio. And that continues, not as much as I wish it would, but that continues into today.
I just wanted to add, Susan has air presence, which is something that may be difficult to define, but you know it. It's like stage presence. And not all reporters have air presence. like that that can host a program. But when Susan comes on, you listen. It's a quality that is important that isn't talked about much, but it was really what I liked about her, and you can hear that every time she comes on the air now.
Can you each share a moment from the early days of NPR that you're particularly proud of? Susan, you want to start?
It's not days from the very beginning, but it goes into around 1973, and the whole Watergate story, Richard Nixon and the Nixon administration being exposed for having essentially, as Bob Woodward said on our air once, tampered with the vote of every American by pressures that the administration exerted. And what I remember, we did daily broadcasts. It was the most sustained broadcasting that we did. It was the biggest story because the Vietnam War had ended fairly soon after we went on the air. The biggest story that we had to cover over a long period of time, the hearings in the Congress, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm proud of having organized groups of citizens, that voice that Bill always wanted to hear, of ordinary people all over the country reacting to the news. That was new in those days and very unusual. And I had a banker in Kansas and a housewife in Wisconsin. I'm not going to remember all of them, but there were about five different ones, Democrats and Republicans. And I would call them every week and just say, so what do you think? You know, how did you react to what you heard this week on the hearings? Because we were broadcasting those hearings live as well. And when the Republican, who had been the Nixon supporter all along, over months and months and months, turned and said, I really have started to have very big questions about what this administration has done and what their aims and what their goals were, that's when we knew that the tide had turned. We heard that on our air from someone whom our listeners had gotten very familiar with because they had heard him week after week. And I love that. I called those features like that the village well, because I had lived in India for some years before there was an NPR and before I came to it. And I would notice passing wells in the small Indian villages, how the villagers, particularly the women, because they did the hard work, hauling the water and carrying it back, the women would gather and talk about the day and react to things that were happening in that village or in the country to the extent that they knew it. And I wanted that sound on the radio. And we made those sounds with our Watergate coverage, as well as in other situations as well. And that is something that's being done to this day on all of our news magazines.
Well, that's a great story. Bill, do you have a memory you could share or something you're especially proud of from the early days of NPR?
I can't top what Susan just described. this is not a heavy thing. I'd just like to mention there was one piece that Susan did with Ira Flatow that was an example of the fun kind of thing that we did on ATC. And that's when there was an idea that if you bit into a wintergreen lifesaver, there would be a little spark. And so Susan and Ira went into the closet and bit into the wintergreen and saw the spark. But I just thought that was an example of the fun and the spirit that was on ATC at that time.
Why don't we hear a short excerpt of that? So this is then science reporter Ira Flatow, now host of Science Friday, and Susan Stamberg, when she was hosting All Things Considered, trying to see what happens when you bite into a wintergreen lifesaver and why are there sparks. And they're going into a dark closet so they could better see the sparks.
Where are we going? Oh, there's the storage closet around the corner from the studio.
Mighty dark in here.
It's extremely.
Okay, now, we have to get to where we can see each other crunching.
Yes. Oh.
So I'll just stand here while our eyes get used to the darkness.
Oh, yeah. Okay, who's going to chew? Are you both chewing?
I'll chew one first.
Yeah.
And then you watch and see what happens. I'll put it in my mouth.
Uh-huh. I saw it.
What did you see?
I saw a flash of kind of greenish light, just for a fraction of a second.
Oh, yeah, let me try it one more time.
Okay. Oh, I want to do this, too. I saw it. Again.
All right, you try it.
This is very bad for your teeth, though. I hope we're not encouraging.
Yeah, oh, goodness.
Did you see it?
Like a little bit of lightning. A little sparkle of lightning.
Nobody could explain this. Very hard to talk and chew at the same time.
Nobody could explain this, and they said they've done some research on it, but they really have no explanation. It's one of the mysteries of science that never gets explained.
Have another life saving. You think Walter Cronkite started like this?
So that was Susan Stamberg and Ira Flatow on All Things Considered back in, was that like 1979?
Yes.
I have to tell you that when my mother heard that, she called and she said, Susan, I mean, I was a married woman and I had a child who was maybe 9 years old. And my mother said, Susan, what are you doing going into dark closets with young men?
That's so funny. Susan, I remember you telling me years ago that you were raised to be a, quote, nice girl. What did that mean? And what did you have to overcome of that to be a good host and journalist and learn how to ask hard questions? And to sometimes, in spite of all your empathy, you sometimes really had to put somebody on the spot and insist on an answer to a difficult question.
Yes. I must say, my dear, that I have the ghost of that continues to haunt me. And it wasn't so much a nice girl. It was a good girl. And, you know, I'm a woman of the 50s. It's when I came up. It was before there was women's liberation. So we were expected to be married, good housewives, and be homemakers. There are wonderful homemakers in this world, and many people listening to this were raised by them. But it didn't fascinate or interest me very much. I always knew that there was more I wanted to do. So I felt, even when there were movements to make women more equal and more authoritative, I felt I always straddled those two worlds, the good girl world and the free and women's liberation girl. And to some extent, I still do. It was very often my impulse to almost talk to myself and say, toughen up, Susan. Don't be too soft on this. Put his feet to the fire. Get an answer that you really do need.
You're both in your 80s now. Neither of you are fully retired. Susan, you're still a special correspondent for NPR. You do pieces on the arts. You write for the NPR website about the arts. And Bill, you're a fellow with the Wincode Foundation, giving talks about and being an advisor at large about public media issues. I'm interested in hearing from each of you why you want to continue, you know, working in some capacity in a decade of your life when a lot of people have retired.
I'll answer first. I don't know how to play golf. I'll tell you the truth. I don't know what I would do with myself, Terry. I'm a widow. So I don't have a partner to turn to or to travel with or do the things that I would do if he were still alive. It's very important to me to keep a focus, to have a structure to my day, because that's all I've ever known since I first started working, and because I can get so involved in the things that I'm curious about and share them with readers and with listeners. And also, I need the IT people because I'm an absolute idiot when it comes to technical stuff. So for all these reasons, I will never retire.
And Bill, what about you?
My work with the Wincote Foundation is ideal for me because I'm dealing with ideas, and I also give talks to university classes or radio stations about the history and also the impact of radio in developing countries. So this is my favorite thing to do, and I love my work, and I just, I don't know how to golf either. And I just want to continue this as long as I can. And I look at this time, as we were doing in this program, looking back in the beginnings, and they were rough, but of course we know that that's the way things begin. And yet I believed in what we were doing, and I believed in the staff. And I think I want to emphasize that so much. I believe what I did, and I think one of my strengths was hiring good people and then managing as I would like to be managed. And my other colleagues had disdain when they saw who I was hiring because sometimes they didn't have broadcast experience. Well, the point was that radio is really quite simple to learn, the mechanics of using a microphone and recording and editing tape, but you can't teach curiosity and passion and compassion and empathy and things like that that I was looking for.
I want to express my gratitude to both of you for all you've done to, you know, create what we know as NPR. And so happy anniversary and congratulations. And on behalf of so many people, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Bill Siemering was NPR's first director of programming and created All Things Considered. Susan Stamberg hosted the show from 1972 to 86. Our thanks to them for helping us celebrate the 50th anniversary of NPR and All Things Considered. The official anniversary is Monday, May 3rd.